Good afternoon, everybody. Can I get your attention? I guess nobody wants to sit up front, huh? We're a little intimidating up this way. Maybe I scared everyone in the earlier session about what might transpire here today, I guess, huh? Well, anyway, thanks. We're running a little late, so I just want to try to get started here, but a few introductory comments. My name's Frank Spicero. I'm with Southern California Gas, and sort of, as I had mentioned before, with SDG&E, we have a reorg going, so I'm kind of on the way out, unfortunately, with SDG&E. I'm going to miss all of my activities down there, but I run the local government partnerships, the institutional partnership programs, and the on-bill financing program for Southern California Gas. And also now picked up some engineering responsibility for the gas company. But I've been doing the local government partnership stuff since it all got started. It's very near and dear to my heart, as well as the on-bill financing stuff is. So that's a little bit of background on my part. If you have any questions from there, you can try to track me down. But just a few logistics before we get started. Cell phones off, please. If I hear any cell phones, I like the tune. I might steal your phone. If I don't, I might throw it out the window. So that's fair warning. The way that we've set the session up is similar to what was done earlier. We're going to have the three speakers present. I'm going to hold questions till the end. For all three, I think, if that's okay. And we've tried to set aside a lot of time for questions, so, you know, this is an opportunity for you guys to interact, and from the earlier sessions, I think there was, you know, plenty of questions, and we had to cut everybody off, so that was a good thing. So just to jump in, we have three speakers. I had mentioned their names earlier, but just to go over that again, first we're going to have Forrest Kayser speak to us. Forrest, sitting here just to my right. He's the program manager of the Energy Technology Assistance Program, or what's finally known as ETAP, I believe. I'm really excited to listen to what he has to say. I want to learn about it myself. I've heard lots of good things about it and how it could work with the utility program, so I'm really looking forward to that. Forrest is the program manager for the program. And he's the lead in developing the program strategies and for oversight of all the program activities. Next, we're going to sort of do a tag team on street lighting, and first we're going to have Linda Pratt from the City of San Diego speak. Linda has more than years of experience in...
Thank you, Frank.
You're welcome. In energy, starting from being a laboratory analyst, which I had no idea that you did that. That's interesting, and I apologize that you had to be a regulatory compliance specialist at one point in your career. I know how hard that is. She's been a consultant, a UCSD adjunct professor. She's managed multi-million-dollar programs for the city, and currently she's the chief program manager for the City of San Diego. There she directs a staff of professionals responsible for the greenhouse gas emissions tracking, energy efficiency and renewable projects, a whole bunch of different things, quite honestly. And, of course, the City of San Diego is a partner with SDG&E, and we've become very good friends and very good partners, I believe, in working together. So look forward to hearing what Linda has to say. And then finally, we have Brendan Reed, who's with the City of Chula Vista. Brendan is also one of our valued partners, and I'm very much looking forward to hear what Brendan has to say about streetlights and his side of the streetlight issue in San Diego. Brendan is the Environmental Resource Manager. Is that your title? Okay. With the city, and he coordinates all the programs and policies dealing with energy management, water conservation, climate change, again, probably a whole bunch of other things. He wears a lot of energy hat issues in the city and has been around there quite a long time. So in the city of Chula Vista has done a lot of cool things, so he's got a lot more than just the streetlight stuff that you could be talking to him about. So I think he's pretty well known around circles, energy efficiency circles, and you definitely want to get to know Brendan. He's a great resource on issues. He also is a lead accredited professional and a certified energy manager. So with that, I am going to first turn it over to Forrest. Forrest, and you know which one your presentation is here.
Yeah, I'll just open that up.
Okay.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm very excited to be here, very happy to talk with you a little bit about the ETAP program. Also very much looking forward to hearing from the other panelists here on the streetlights in San Diego. There's definitely some overlap in terms of some of the technologies that you can use in this program and in streetlights. So it's going to be an exciting session here. Just real quickly, this is going to be what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the focus technologies that ETAP supports, the services that we provide to local governments, and then really just kind of overview on each one of those technologies, walk through what the opportunities are typically in city and county and local government facilities, and what kind of rebates we provide, what the financials look like, and how you can get involved. So to give you a little bit of background on the program, we are a SEP program of the California Energy Commission. So back in 2009, that part of the stimulus bill made funding available to all the states for the state energy programs. And one of the areas that the Energy Commission wanted to support was controls. And that was seen as a very promising area for realizing new energy savings opportunities. So we designed a program based on our company's experience doing evaluations of some of these emerging technologies and working with local governments through local government partnership programs that we've run on behalf of PG&E. And we decided to focus on these three targeted areas because these ones were the ones that seemed the most ready to go in terms of there's research that's already been done establishing that these can save energy in public facilities in California. And you know, these are really market-ready technologies that just aren't that widespread yet. So these are the ones that, with a little bit of extra boost in terms of technical assistance and rebates, could really help to start transform the market. So the three main areas that we support are bi-level lighting for parking garages and parking lots. So bi-level, for those of you who haven't heard that phrase before, it may not be intuitive. Bi-level just means there's two light levels. When the space is unoccupied, it's at a lower level. When someone's in that space, the light level comes up, so it's at a brighter level. Wireless lighting controls is another measure that we support, and there's some overlap between those first two, which I'll get into, and then wireless HVAC controls. So all of these measures, they deliver cost-effective energy savings. We've seen this through peer studies and other third-party evaluations. They deliver very short payback periods. But a couple other special features of these measures that others don't share are that they are really minimally invasive. When you go to install these technologies, you don't have to run a lot of wires. Because they're wireless, it allows you to really work with some buildings that where there's asbestos issues are otherwise very difficult to retrofit. So they're great great options for those types of facilities. They're also very customizable, so you can adapt the lighting or the HVAC controls to how the space is used. So if your space changes over time, it's very easy to reconfigure your system to adapt to the needs of that building. They typically integrate very well with existing systems, so if you already have a building automation system, you can plug one of these technologies in, and it'll all play together nicely. So what ETAP does is we provide free technical assistance. So everything that we do for local governments is paid for from the stimulus money from the CEC. So we provide the upfront assistance to help cities and counties identify facilities that are good fits for these technologies. So because they're targeted, you know, there's not a wide portfolio of measures we're supporting. There's these three targeted ones. So there's not always a good fit with every facility and every agency. So part of what we do up front is work with you to say, whether there's any good matches. So we can help scope out the project. If there's some promising opportunities, we can send people out and actually inspect the facilities, interact with facility staff, and really get the detailed information we need to assess that opportunity and give you a report on what the feasibility of a retrofit would be. We can help you look for other financial resources. So some of our participating agencies are looking at low-interest loans from the CEC that we can help with. Many are just using block grants. So that's an easy way to use some block grant funds is to we reduce the project cost by adding our rebates. We try to do whatever we can to help the project move forward. So we're kind of, act at, scale our assistance to your needs to help a project move forward. Okay, so just want to go into a little bit more detail on each of these measure areas to describe them a little more, give you a more concrete sense of what they're all about and what the opportunities are. So the first one is wireless HVAC controls. So these can really deliver some significant savings. So wireless networking can give you basically a DDC retrofit, so direct digital control retrofit. So very fine control of your zones without the full cost of doing a full DDC retrofit. So this is especially good when you have a building that has a constant air volume system, where you have a fan that's just blowing at the same speed all the time. So you're blowing air through the building, regardless of what the actual energy demand is in that building. And what the wireless HVAC, what the DART system can do is, you know, with you install VFDs, and the DART system acts as kind of like an artificial intelligence control algorithm that adjusts your fan speeds depending on the energy demand in that building. So you save on fan speed. That's the biggest energy saving right there, is in reducing those fan speeds. But also, because you're moving a smaller volume of air, you also get heating and cooling savings as well. The other things these products that we support do, and I'm going to kind of move through these a little bit quickly, but another thing that they do is they just by providing zone level information, you can really improve your maintenance operations. So by really knowing what's happening in individual zones, what's the temperature in that zone, you know if you have zones that are fighting against each other, and you can really help pinpoint where trouble issues are very quickly and very specifically in the building. So that can save you a lot of money actually in maintenance costs. So there's two different products that we support in this general measure area of wireless HVAC controls. One is the pneumatic thermostat replacement, so wireless pneumatic thermostats. For buildings where there's pneumatic thermostats, this is a great option. This is a great option to increase your level of control and increase the information that you have about each zone without a lot of cost. So, and without a lot of retrofit, intrusive retrofit. So you can really just pop these old pneumatic thermostats off the wall, put these new wireless pneumatic thermostats on. The old pneumatic system works the same way, but then you add the centralized control and you add information coming from each zone and being able to be centralized in one place and controlled. So you can see energy savings anywhere from 10 to 25% with this product. It's a little bit lower than with the DART system, which I just mentioned, because you're not actually controlling fan speeds necessarily. What you're doing is you're doing setbacks, and you're doing dead band zone control. You're enabling yourself to do a lot of energy efficiency measures that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, or would be very costly to do if you just had regular pneumatic thermostats. DART is the system where you actually install VFDs, and then this is the software that controls the fan speeds in response to the building energy demand. And you get a lot more savings there because of that fan speed reduction. So 25 to 55% is a pretty typical range. There are battery operated devices that are located out in the throughout the building. So those are the sensors that are delivering that zone specific information to the central hub. And the system does monitor that battery level. That's a question you get a lot of times. Well, what about that battery? So you get feedback about what the battery is doing, what state it's in, so you don't just have the battery run out and not know what's going on in that zone. So typically, we're seeing like two-year lifetimes on the batteries. But again, you do get that notification, so you know when they need to be changed. I mentioned this already, so I'm going to skip through this. It really helps you with maintenance and troubleshooting because you know what's actually happening in the zones. And our rebate for this is 18 cents a kilowatt hour. And so we basically, as part of our upfront analysis, we'll estimate what the expected energy savings are, and that's what your rebate would be based on. We typically provide the rebate upfront. We'll do some post-install data collection, but we typically don't adjust the rebate after that because we want to give you the confidence that you're going to get X amount of money to make this project happen. So we do report that and we collect that information, but we just take that risk that the project's going to deliver the savings that we expect it to. There are utility incentives that you can add on top of that, and that's something that makes these projects especially attractive right now. So for this brief window where we have this stimulus funding available through this ETAP program, you can actually take your utility rebate and then add on top of it our rebate. So you add 9 cents, 18 cents, you're starting to get to a very cost-effective project for a narrow window. Here's some example example paybacks and just energy savings. So for bigger buildings, you know, you could see a 200,000 square foot building, you know, you might save half a gigawatt hour on an annual basis and with a sub 1 year payback. So it's a pretty outstanding project right there from a, you know, if you look at energy efficiency projects, I mean, that's a really fast payback, and we are seeing some projects like that in the field. WPTs, you know, you see that is a little bit longer payback. Again, the energy savings potential is a little bit lower with the WPTs just because you don't have that fan speed control. So it's wireless HVAC. Those are the two products we currently support. We do, if there are individual products that agencies are interested in, we do have a process of evaluating new products and including them in the program and rebating them. And we have a detailed set of specifications. So we don't typically go out there and look for new products because of the short time frame that this program operates on. But if there's an agency that has a project that they want to do and they have, you know, they have all the data about that product, then we will evaluate it and request permission from the Energy Commission to include it in the program. Okay, so the next two measures are the lighting measures that we support. The first one is the bi-level lighting for parking lots and parking garages. This is a great opportunity. A lot of times parking lot lighting is on, parking garage lighting is on 24/7, and so there's a big savings potential with those types of facilities. A lot of times they use older high-intensity discharge fixtures or multi-lamp fluorescents. Again, that increases the savings opportunity. Sometimes there's daylighting opportunities that aren't really being taken advantage of in garages. And all those things add up to more savings when you start controlling those fixtures. So the way that the bi-level measure works is that we provide a rebate per fixture depending on the technology involved in the fixture. So each fixture has an integrated occupancy sensor that that detects whether someone is there or not and reduces the light level to 50% or less when someone is not around. So this works well in garages and lots and stairwells and pathways. So I'll get back to this because in the wireless measure, you can actually add wireless controls to the same types of spaces as well. But for this particular measure, it's a little bit more straightforward to just do a one-for-one fixture replacement with an integrated occupancy sensor. It's a little bit easier to conceptualize and less intimidating at times for maintenance staff. You can see energy savings, you know, it's a pretty wide range, and part of actually what we're doing for the Energy Commission on this program is collecting data about how often these fixtures are in the high-level mode and how often they're in the low-level mode. So we're seeing savings, you know, 25% to 70%, and we'll be collecting data and adjusting our estimates as we move forward. A couple of the advantages that you can see from these projects are, you know, apart from the energy savings, improved light quality. So you're switching out old high-pressure sodium lights to LED or efficient fluorescence, and you really see a drastic improvement in the temperature of that light and color rendering. It also, the lamps that we support typically last longer, so you have improved maintenance costs. And the safety issues come in a couple of ways. That's something that's actually people are often concerned about, you know, with a lower level. Oftentimes you see the lower level of the new retrofit lights can even match the existing light level. So it's not a huge concern, but safety is actually enhanced usually with the bi-level lighting in a couple of ways. One is that color rendering and improved light quality. So it's easier to see people, it's easier to recognize them, it's easier to identify people. The other thing is that there's a notification feature when you have an occupancy sensor. So actually in a recent install, the people were joking that you can actually in a garage, you can see if there's someone that the cops are chasing or something in the garage, you can kind of see them move through the garage as the lights brighten up as they move along. So it is generally seen as a safety enhancement, but that is an issue that sometimes needs some discussion with various stakeholders within city government and the public. So here's our incentive levels. We do $200 for each LED fixture, $100 for induction and fluorescence, and then if you're just retrofitting the lamp and ballast, so you're just switching them out to more efficient versions that are bi-level capable, then it's a $40 incentive. So again, these are on top of the incentives that are available from the utilities. So you know, you start adding these up, and they really make projects really worthwhile and really cost-effective. I've seen sub 1 year paybacks on these projects as well. I think the examples here show them more in like two to three years. I think it's probably a little more typical, but in some garages, you know, the lights haven't been retrofitted in a long time, and you can see really, really fast paybacks. And we support, there's a wide variety of products out there for bi-level lighting and fluorescence in particular, LED as well, that we do support, and we kind of look at it as a project-by-project basis. So we look at Design Lights Consortium for LED standards, and then so we evaluate it on a project. There's too many out there, so we don't have a list of all the pre-qualified fluorescent fixtures. But there's a wide variety of options there. So wireless lighting control is the last measure, and there's some overlap with bi-level. And so it's wireless lighting control for parking garages, but also for interior spaces. So the bi-level incentive that's per fixture is only for garages, but the wireless can span any type of space. So you know, control is always an option where you have a overlighting condition. So we have unoccupied areas that are lit by banks of lights that are controlled by on one circuit that you can't switch those off because they're lighting up some other space that is occupied. And oftentimes even people would prefer to have it darker above their desks, but again, it's all in one circuit and you can't reduce that lighting level. So wireless control allows you to do that. Allows you to, at the extreme, have personalized control above every desk in an office. And studies have shown that even giving personal control, people oftentimes just turn the lights off, and you get big savings just from giving people that type of control over their environment. You can also do scheduling easily with wireless networks. You can do daylight harvesting. You can integrate any type of energy saving strategy that you can think of pertaining to lighting. So you can have them all in one system, centralized control, and dynamically readjustable. So if you move desks around or you change your space, you can change the way that the lighting works. You can add switches to walls where there's no where you don't have to actually run wires to the lights because you have the wireless control. So it's very flexible. It's very adaptive, and it has some significant savings opportunities there. So 18 cents a kilowatt hour, again, like the HVAC control measure. And once again, on top of the utility incentives, it can really add up to some great savings. For garages in particular, I think there's a, there's a lot of times people are trying to choose whether they're doing the bi-level incentive or the wireless. And we basically just look at it and see what is going to make the most sense financially for the city, and we'll provide whatever rebate is going to be higher. But sometimes there's other design elements that come into consideration that wireless lighting allows you to do, that integrated single occupancy sensor fluorescent fixtures don't. So the wireless lighting control network would allow you to turn on, for example, a whole row of lights in a garage as a car enters, instead of having it blink on one by one as the car approaches each individual light. So you get a little bit more seamless lighting experience with a wireless control. Sometimes it's more expensive, but actually sometimes it's less. If you have a really inefficient base case, when you use our 18 cents kilowatt hour rebate, sometimes actually the wireless lighting option can be more inexpensive. So you have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis. Typically, we do see a little bit higher paybacks on these, though, because of the expense involved in the wireless system. But again, these are very easy to install. There's a little controller that's about the size of a stick of butter that goes up in the ballast cavity of your fluorescent fixtures, and it talks to, it controls that individual fixture, and then it talks to the network. So it's programmed by the network and subject to any kind of control that you set from your central hub. So in terms of participation, currently our program is open to cities and counties, really any kind of local public government agency that's out there, special districts. And we also serve universities, college campuses, community colleges, CSUs, UCs, no other state governments, but really anything that's a local government we can serve. There is also a way for contractors, and this is probably not the same audience here, but the contractors can actually help, can also be involved in the program by bringing projects that they are already working on with. So if you have a contractor that you're already working with, you know, we can fast track that project, and we can just make sure that we get the information we need to be comfortable with the energy savings and the analysis, and then we can just handle all the paperwork and make sure that that project is getting the rebates that it deserves. Again, if you have a product that you're working with, that you're excited about, we can take a look at it and qualify it for a rebate if it meets our specs. And again, another reminder is that you can combine these with utility incentives. So when you add these up, it really does create some unique project financials, but only through the end of this year. We have until March to spend all of the stimulus funding, so it's kind of a limited time frame to get projects installed. And so I encourage you, if you have any that are sort of in the works that you're thinking about, that you're considering, that you're maybe the financials aren't quite working out, definitely get in touch with me. My email address is on this presentation. I think it's going to be available online. And I have some handouts here I'll make available that describe each of our technology areas. But the best way is just to actually contact me directly, and we'll get you set up with an individual contact within our program staff that can walk you through the process of evaluating your facilities and figuring out what opportunities might exist. So we have, this is an outdated slide. We've got about half of our $2.5 million that's unclaimed right now. We've got projects in the pipeline that would definitely use up the rest of it, but it's kind of a first come, first serve. So if you have a project that's ready to go, you know, there's ample opportunity to get your project considered and rebated. And so we got, I think, over 60 participants at this point, but we're definitely still actively recruiting new ones. So I encourage you, if you have any interest, definitely please feel free to reach out to me and find out how you can participate. Thank you so much for your time.
Good afternoon. Hang on. Okay, my name is Linda Gianelli Pratt. You'll notice there's another name on that slide, and it is Tom Cartier, who is really the guru of our street lighting program, and I just wanted to make that clear before the question and answer period. Oh, and I also want to tell you that just like with any great program, whenever you go to the movies now, you see that there's a, you know, executive producer and five different producers to make the movie come on budget. This street lighting, broad spectrum street lighting program is brought to you by the CPUC funded local government partnerships, EECBC, EECBG, CEC, and the QECBs. And there's probably a couple other ones in there as well. All right, so back in 2002, the city of San Diego converted from low-pressure sodium to high-pressure sodium. And the reason was because we felt that high-pressure sodium was a better light, that you could see more. It was a public safety issue. However, it really is not that great of a light. And the question then became, why did we stay with the high-pressure sodium? Why didn't we do something else? And the reason is the Dark Sky Society. Well, one of the main reasons. Their logo down there is America, we have a problem, light pollution. And I had in my original presentation, I had a little picture of a Dracula guy at night. But then I remembered Frank as an avid astronomer, and I didn't want anyone to be offended, mostly Frank. So the city of San Diego has a number of mountain areas that have observatories, and that would be Mount Palomar and Mount Laguna. And we have a requirement that within a 30-mile radius, we needed to use low-pressure sodium, or the high-pressure sodium also worked for that. We knew that high-pressure sodium was very energy-intensive. Something that happened unexpectedly when we were doing a routine library interior lighting retrofit is that we saved energy with the lights, but we also noticed for the first time, and probably you all noticed this immediately when you did these kinds of lighting retrofits, we noticed that it provided better visual performance. Why was that? Because the monochromatic light from the high-pressure sodium prohibits color rendition. It's very boring that way, and it's also a concern for public safety because you're not able to more clearly define the colors. And you know why. This is all about the rods and cones in your eyes, and I'm happy to answer any questions during the question and answer period of how that works. So we decided that this is an issue that doesn't just affect the city of San Diego. It affects the whole San Diego region. And we put forward a streetlight working group that is comprised of a number of organizations. Clean Tech San Diego, which is a nonprofit organization, is a co-lead along with San Diego Gas and Electric. Many municipalities participate. Chula Vista and San Diego probably participate most actively, and the County of San Diego, my mistake, in case anybody's here, participate very actively in it. And we also have one of those wonderful local government energy efficiency best practices for the whole street lighting program, the working group, and how it came to be, and all of the players involved. This is what the street light working group said. We have taken a technology agnostic approach since there is no one size fits all solution. And that's what you're going to hear in my presentation and compared with Brendan's presentation. And that's a really important point. We're not advocating broad spectrum lighting for everyone, but in our case, it worked. And this tells you a little bit about Clean Tech San Diego, and they have a lot more information available about street lighting. How many of you are working on street lighting problems right now? Do you find this topic fascinating? Yes. How many of the rest of you that aren't working on street lighting, do you find this topic fascinating? You will. Okay. All right. So City of San Diego street lighting needs. We have nearly 38,000 street lights that we need to retrofit. We need to comply with the dark sky guidelines. We need to decide on technologies, identify specific requirements and criteria, develop an RFP, and provide public outreach. And as you know, because we're using ECBG funds for part of this, we have like a couple of days to put it all together to make the project viable and to use the money before all the ECBG funding goes away. So this is our need that we put forward to the Streetlight Working Group, and obviously it was the need of many other cities as well. We did this very cool project, again, in collaboration with Clean Tech San Diego, San Diego Gas and Electric, the CEC. I want to commend them as well. It was fun. I got to tell my kids that I was going to walk 6th Avenue at night, which really isn't such a good thing normally, but it was with a bunch of people, so it was fine. We set up a number of different pilot projects. So there was the high-pressure sodium lights, there was the broad-spectrum lighting, and there was LED. And we did a number of different evaluations based on some criteria that were given to us, actually by a university back east, came out and also helped us with it. So we looked at luminance. So we had to, all the people that were participating, all volunteers, had to say, you know, I think this one is shiny. I think this one's really great. You know, reaction time, we were all driving in this test vehicle, not all at the same time, but a number of us were driving in these test vehicles. It was very cool. And there would be these, you know, little things on the side of the road that we were supposed to look for. And as we were driving down, going underneath all of the different types of streetlights, you know, they looked at our reaction time, how quickly we saw those things on the road, and we were able to push a button, and it was registered in terms of our reaction time. And then we had the subjective public evaluation. We tried to get the word out to as many people as possible that this is what we were working on. If you'd like to participate, come with us. And it was a great success, and I think we all had a good time working together on this. All right, so our preliminary results from that 6th Avenue walk at night was that there was no significant difference between the existing 250-watt high-pressure sodium and the 170-watt broad-spectrum lights. So then our decision was, okay, we can get good lighting, but how do we decide between LED and induction? Well, our decision was broad-spectrum lighting, and I'll tell you why. We had equal or better visual performance, as I just mentioned. We had energy savings of 40 to 60% projected, and we felt the maintenance savings would be pretty significant. Life cycle cost analysis, we ran through a number of different variables, looked at maintenance costs, look at inflation. I think we did a 2.5% inflation, and looked at energy costs converted to simple payback years for financing. And then this is what our results were, and I know those are a lot of numbers and you may not be able to see it, but with the 250-watt HPS, the annual 20-year life cycle costs were $4,558. For induction lighting, it was $2,827. And then for the LED, it was $5,860. So you look at all of that, and for us, the best deal at that time was the induction lighting in terms of a 20-year life cycle cost assessment. So again, looking at it, we had a 6.4-year payback period. If you include all the other factors, a seven-year payback period if you just do a simple payback. With LED, it was about a 17.1 payback period, and then simple payback of about 17.6. This is an example of a Cobra Head light, and we think they're quite lovely. Projections for energy savings, this is the part that's very cool, and for me, in my part of the program, I need to be able to make the information transferable to the general public to make them understand what our benefits are. I can tell them that at 16 million kilowatt hours that we would save after we retrofit the roughly 38,000 streetlights, but that's a hard number to get your head around. So it's also equal, using very standard conversion factors that you all have access to, it's also equal to about 2,200, 2,300 cars removed, 1,450,000 gallons of gas saved. Or the one that seems to resonate most with people is it's the same as 4,426 homes off the grid. Are you going to give the total number? I'll let you use that number. Okay. I'm not going to tell you something, but Brendan's going to tell you something really cool. All right. So if you want more information, you can look at our city website, and that's www.sandiego.gov. And there's you can go to our energy page. And there is a section there called Programs and Projects, Energy Alliances, and Peer-to-Peer. And if you have more questions, you can contact either Tom Cartier, who would be your better bet if you needed to ask really technical questions, or you can contact me. And I just wanted you to know that this is, again, another example of working to demystify the resource cross-threading of collaborative integration for expanding and leveraging streetlight technology. And if you want to use that as your mission statement for everything, we used every buzzword we could think of to do that. So that's our presentation. Thank you.
Hello. Again, my name is Brendan Reed. I'm with the City of Chula Vista. And so we want to thank the organizers for inviting the City of Chula Vista to participate. A couple things before I get started. You know, there was a lot of talk yesterday about TRC, total resource cost. And in the SDG&E program area, we partners are a non-resource program. But I wanted to point out that it's because of the partnership program, no doubt about this, it's because of this partnership program and the resources that it brings local governments that the streetlight working group was able to happen. And as a result, if all the streetlights in our region were to be converted, and I guarantee that they probably all will be converted in the next 5 years, that's going to equate to 60 million kWh in savings annually, and that's saving $10 million in utility costs. So I really, you know, it might not be a direct resource cost or recovery for the utilities, but I think all of us in this room have to do a better job of sharing our stories, it sounds like, at the state level about how local government partnerships really do bring added value. So I think this is just an example. Before I go any further, I also want to do a disclaimer like Linda did. Rob LeClaire, who is our traffic signal and streetlight guru, he's really the technical guy behind this. I participated in some working group, streetlight working group meetings, but he was really the guru in that, so I will also defer any hard questions to him. Streetlights are important. I think for us and probably a lot of you in this crowd, again, it's not a question of if, but it's a question of how you're going to move forward with it. So this was my exciting title. But we've had a lot of stormtroopers and Klingons walking around our area with Comic-Con. So my other title is Close Encounters of the Streetlight Kind. You're lucky I didn't come dressed as either of those things. Oh, and then because clearly aliens have evolved to some sort of better, more efficient energy-efficient lighting, because they wouldn't have all these things on their spaceship if they weren't efficient lights, I'm sure. So I'm going to just talk about why streetlights are really important for the city, especially me in my role leading the climate program, talk about our inventory. Then I'll talk about how we've transitioned from a demonstration or a pilot phase into now actually implementing it. We're about 3 weeks into implementation. And then next steps, our plans for the future. So Chula Vista, it's the second largest city in the county of San Diego, but we're only 230,000 people, so we're like 1/6 of Linda's city size. But we are the second largest. We have about 700 utility meters, energy utility meters, at about 90 different sites. And our annual electricity use is somewhere around 18 million kWh. And obviously, streetlights are important because 38% of our electricity use is attributable to streetlights. This map here is just something that we've created recently. We've just taken all of our meter data and put it into a GIS layer. And then, obviously, the bigger the circles are, the more consumption there are at that site. And the blue is electricity and red is natural gas. But I would encourage folks to do this, because all of a sudden we saw all these patterns and trends that we're like, oh, we probably should look into why we have all this consumption that seems really disproportionate. Somehow maps make it easier. On a climate front, 38% of electricity use is from streetlights, and about 32% of our electricity cost is from streetlights. It's a little bit less because, you know, it's off-peak. And then it's 25% of total energy use. So this is kind of a big thing. This is a low-hanging fruit, but a big one. This is like a giant watermelon hanging. And I know they don't even grow on trees, but in this case, they do. So obviously, we had a clear mission to address this. Our current inventory includes about 9,000 streetlights, so a lot smaller than Linda's. And in our area, these are actually under the LS2 tariff. So the city actually owns the infrastructure. And these are not, if you don't know streetlights very well, they're all non-metered. It's something that comes up later. So they're not metered. You just tell SDG&E how many streetlights you have at this wattage, where they are, and then you get billed for that. We have almost kind of a 50-50 split between residential streets, which have 100-watt high-pressure sodium now, and the other half, more or less, is 250-watt, which is on arterial streets. This map here, I'm a map guy. This map here is actually something we're doing now as we're implementing our streetlight project. We're creating a GIS layer with actual coordinates for each of the streetlights. You think that's how it's been done, but really, if you look at your streetlight inventory, it's like 250 yards west of the intersection. So we feel like it's about time to kind of go to the digital age, and it's this retrofit project is really creating an opportunity to do that cost effectively. Actually, we're making our contractor do this for us for free. So we began our journey on the streetlight retrofit process with an assessment project, very similar to the city of San Diego. We had about a mile long stretch of arterial roadway in a newer part of our city that, unfortunately, because of the housing bust, there was no houses around it. So we used this as a testing area for us. And what we did is we actually went out and solicited products from vendors. So it was, you know, if you want us to consider your product for this project, you could, you know, make a lot of money at the end of the day, you need to give us a sample for free. And we had lots of people calling us and lots of people wanting to send us stuff. But probably one of the best things is we did is we made them all products require what's called LM79 and LM80 evaluations, like a third-party review. And this is a third-party review of, you know, how efficient the light is, what's the light quality, what's the lumen maintenance or depreciation over time. And just by doing that, 90% of the folks that contacted us could not actually give us product. So something very important, because I know all of you are probably in the same circumstance as me, and I apologize if there's any kind of contractors out here, but you get a call every day from someone who has the best technology and they want to set up a meeting with you. So this helped us definitely filter out folks that were not really the products that weren't mature enough to be in a production phase yet. So, well, this didn't turn out very well, but we had 32 test fixtures that were submitted to us. There were 20 LED, 10 induction, and 2 high pressure sodium. And the 2 high pressure sodium were actually single top posts. So one of our thoughts were, well, maybe we just don't need 2 Cobra heads. Maybe we can just move to 1 high-pressure sodium, and hence you've reduced your energy use by 50%. So we set all of these fixtures up. There was basically 2 in a row along this 1-mile segment. They were positioned, I think it's 250 feet between each fixture, and we did that so obviously you could get a sense of what, imagine what like a whole street would look like for each fixture type. And we ran that for, it was about a year long. We did have all the poles marked so folks could give us their feedback. You know, we definitely didn't organize something as robust as Linda's project, but I think more or less in our city, if you say that it's going to save us energy, they're pretty much behind you. And also, if you tell them that it'll help with public safety, you know, no one bad mouths cops, so that's definitely a good way to get it through. So some of the things that we were looking at were through the field observations were just performance. You know, we really did want to see, kind of compare these new technologies to high-pressure sodium because that's what our community is used to. We looked at light quality, the distribution, the lumens, the reliability of the project, the product, the serviceability, the aesthetics, that color rendering index, the color temperature, energy consumption, and, of course, cost savings. And after that, we did more or less at that point choose to go with LED technology, mainly because it mimicked a lot of the light patterns of high-pressure sodium, and it had greater controllability. One thing that we want to kind of go into next is, you know, dimmable and advanced lighting controls, and they have a finer grain dimming capability, LEDs, and then, of course, the energy savings. But sort of as all journeys, this is where we ended up, but actually about 8 months ago, we were on the road down induction, and mainly because the cost, the payback wouldn't work. And I was funding this through a CEC loan, and actually we got one of those 1% loans, so we were very excited. But the payback simply didn't work. And you know, word must have spread because we had LED manufacturers, you know, calling us and begging us to still open it up and give them or allow them a chance to bid the project. And you know, they were able to bring it down to the cost of comparable to induction. And that was a big thing. I think that was kind of the tipping point when we knew, okay, then we feel comfortable moving forward with LED. So now we've moved from this pilot phase into actual implementation. We've been implementing for, oh, I was going to get this later. But we've been implementing for, since the second week of July, we have about 500 fixtures installed. We're averaging about 300 per week. And, you know, on my side of the shop, who does a lot of more of the financing, the policy, and getting the projects ready, it is one of the most straightforward retrofit projects we've ever done. I mean, we have one fixture, we're replacing with another, and we just have to do that 4,600 times. It's very straightforward. There's no VAVs, VFDs. I mean, it is the most straightforward energy efficiency project you can get. So how we did this, though, was we actually, once we knew we were going LED, we knew that generally it would work within our financing, we did use a design-build RFP. And that was the vehicle through which we did the contracting. This was because we wanted the contractor then to really be our middleman, if you will, and then deal with all of the manufacturers. And so they actually went out and solicited and then ranked the LED fixtures on a number of performance criteria. Some of the information that the contractor gave as a result of that is what you see here. It's a visual rendering of a street with, you know, this was one fixture type. And just looking at, again, the light color and the distribution. And then the bottom is a thermal image, again, looking at like sort of the hot to cold thermal footprint. So these are kind of the tools that we did that allowed us to compare to existing conditions. And then for each project, we also put together an ISOLUX footprint. And that is just, again, looking at on a grid, what is the foot candle? So this is at ground level, how much light you actually getting versus how much light it's putting out. And so this, again, allowed us another opportunity to look at the footprint of the light as also sort of summary stats on average and maximum foot candles, et cetera, et cetera. So we really made it quantitative, and that helped us justify our product. Some other things that we did look at, though, in the ranking was warranty, how long the warranty was, obviously price, how long the manufacturer had been in existence. And, you know, with LEDs, we're not talking long. And we looked at what they call the L70 value. It's the time or how long it takes for 50% of the lights to be at 70% of lumens. Because at that point, you have to replace the LED. LEDs don't have a filament, so they don't burn out like normal lights. So they were all ranked, and that led us to our decision. So kind of the high-end or the high-level project stats, and this is the stuff I always deal with. So it's about $2.2 million gross project costs. We have an excellent rebate from SDG&E for $230. And we're looking at annual savings close to $1 million kWh and $200,000. So the net costs, the net simple payback is about 10 years. And again, we got a great interest rate from the CEC for that. So I do want to kind of highlight just some of the lessons learned. And some of these were the hard way. As all good lessons, I guess, the ones you don't forget. First off, I already mentioned it, requiring that independent third-party testing. It's an easy way to only have really serious products considered in your project. Streetlights take an awful lot of coordination with your investor-owned utility, first being rebate eligibility. For ours, the fixtures had to be listed on the designlights.org website, so we had to make sure of that. And then, as I mentioned, they're not metered. So SDG&E, and I always point to you, I'm sorry, SDG&E here won't give me my better rate on my streetlights until I tell them, you know, we've switched out 300, this is the location, et cetera. So we've created a system where it's almost every week we're going to be submitting rebate applications, if you will. They're already reserved, but a request for payment, I guess it is, and our tariff switch documentation. And so that we actually will start accumulating these savings right away. Very important. Obviously, your warranty should be 10 plus years. With LED, that was a consideration. I mean, one of the things with induction is, especially in like the city of San Diego, they've been using them for 20 years with great success. You know, LED was a little bit new. I think something that helped comfort us in our decision was that they're not that new, though. I mean, they're new maybe for a streetlight application, but our traffic signals have been using them fine, and that was one of the other greatest energy efficiency retrofits we've ever done. And even to our beautiful holiday lights on our Civic Center complex. So, I mean, you know, LEDs, maybe they're new in the streetlight application, but they've really been around for a while. We do put in a local purchasing and hiring requirements, all right, I shouldn't say it's a requirement, but we give preference and we give extra points to contractors who integrate that. So this $2.2 million investment is being, those product is being bought through a local supplier for fixtures. Have the contractor receive rebate directly. All those things about working with SDG&E every week, I don't have to deal with it. Our contractor has to. So they're the ones on the hook to make sure the SDG&E gets that information because they want that rebate. One of the things we did too is when we started having this conversation, we included our planning department. We do have some greenfield growth in our city left. And so obviously the decisions we were making for existing streetlights, they're going to impact our new streetlight areas as well. So we had engineering and planning department staff involved so that they've now written the specs for our new developments and new master plan community. So we have a uniformity across our city. And the last being communicate with stakeholders, both internal and external. And I can say that we've been, again, we've started implementing this. We've put out press releases. It's been our newsletters. It's been in the newspaper, our local newspaper. And no news is good news. So I haven't had any calls yet from anyone telling me that they hate the new lights, which is good. So just where do we go from here? I'm currently trying to finalize my QECBs, or my Qualified Energy Conservation Bonds, to fund our next phase. This would be focused on our arterial streets, and we'd be able to do about 3,000, of the 3,600 more or less remaining lights. These are larger wattages. We're moving from 250 probably down to a 140 or 150 LED. And so I hope to finalize the financing by August 16th is our council meeting. But we are really excited. Pretty much after phase two, the majority of our lights will be installed, and that would last through the new year. And you know, that's a significant savings because, again, we're going from more or less we're cutting our streetlights energy use in half. So something we're very proud of. And I have to say, with the qualified energy conservation bonds, if you got them, you should use them. The going interest rate is about 2%, and because of the bond term that's set by the Treasury, which is really long, we actually are cash positive the first year. So now my trick is to follow the great lead of San Jose and try to convince my higher-ups to let me keep that money and not give it to public safety. So thank you for your time, and we'll probably open up to questions.
Okay, so we have about 15, 20 minutes for questions. One ground rule is please be loud enough so I can hear you, which may be a problem because I've got more than 25 years. So, and I'll repeat the question just to make sure everybody hears it. So, in the back. Okay, so the first question is, Brendan, are you looking at the dimmable, controllable LEDs at all and what your plans are there? And then we'll answer that one first.
Okay. Yes, one of the challenges we're having is that there's currently not a tariff set up. It's not metered. So there's not a way to reap the benefits of an adaptive control system on your utility bill that I'm aware of. Yeah, we're not involved. I'm personally not involved in that. And I know we've begun the conversations with SDG&E on the subject. And I look forward to the outcome of those conversations. But that was one of the big things. And plus, because of the cost and our funding mechanism, we did have to, you know, we just met the payback period. So if there was any additional cost at this point. But that's definitely our long-term goal.
Okay. So, and then the second question could probably go to both of you guys about group purchases of the hardware.
So one of the benefits of working with a streetlight working group is that the RFP was actually developed to a large extent by the streetlight working group. And for ours, there's a piggyback clause on ours. So if you wanted to use our same RFP, you certainly could. And, you know, we are not... we're not actively working with all of the other cities directly, the city of San Diego, but I know the Streetlight Working Group has a number of smaller cities that are participating and the county of San Diego. And so they, I believe, are actually looking at whether or not they can piggyback on our contract.
Likewise, we have a piggyback clause in our contract as well for other public agencies.
So the question real quick, just to repeat, is how you're calculating the savings because you're unmetered. Yes? Or
Well, I mean, they're not metered, but we still pay for the electricity use. It's just a estimated use based on the wattage and the number of hours. So one of the reasons why I say it's the most straightforward project is because they can tell me exactly to the cent how much money I'm going to save. There's no issues with, you know, peak use or you know, operations. It's all just an equation.
I think a big part was the financing, the cost of the LEDs. And again, Brendan has 9,000. How many streetlights? 9,000, and we had about nearly 48,000. I'm sorry, 38,000. And so no one ever came to us and said, wait, because I think maybe they can make that price cut for 9,000 to get their product out there. But it's a bigger sacrifice on their part, I believe, to do it for 38,000.
Yeah, I think one of...
Oh, yeah. That's right, too. So the finance, yeah. But we couldn't anyway because of the observatory, because we're closer than Chula Vista is. We're within that 30-mile radius, and so that was the other piece of it, too. Sorry. But the financing was a big part of it as well. It just wasn't possible.
More questions?
Yeah, it was a really great question, and I think, you know, it's definitely something that we've heard from others as well, you know, concern with additional components and failure and just the staff time required to learn a new system and understand how it works. And I think... You know, really, the best answer is that, you know, the information that these systems provide should make maintenance an easier task because of the zone. Like, for example, with the HVAC control system, you're getting zone level information that just wasn't previously available, and you're able to view all of that from one location, so you don't have to go hunting around for where the problems are, and you're really simplifying that maintenance task. I think, you know, in terms of complexity, you know, a lot of the components are really not, you know, it's, in fact, Vigilant, the product, the company that makes the DART system, you know, they actually kind of see themselves as more of an IT company than an HVAC company. And so the technology there, it's not, you know, it's not particularly prone. There's not really sensitive components like, you know, your economizer on your roof or something like that. It's pretty robust, well-established types of technology. So, you know, I think that it's a valid concern, but I think that the companies have done a good job at delivering a product that really makes maintenance an easier rather than a more difficult task.
I had a related question for us. You mentioned that you had the technology assistance component to the program, and I missed it, but I wasn't quite sure what that covered. Is it limited to the three items that you were talking about, or was it a bit broader than that or not, and what does it do?
Yeah. So, I mean, our assistance is really... It is limited to those three areas, and what it's about is trying to figure out whether any of those three measure types are a good fit for your agency and your facilities. So we will review your facilities, we'll talk over the measures, when they're typically appropriate, when they typically will realize savings for you, and collect as detailed information as we possibly can to really give you a solid feasibility analysis that tells you what the expected energy savings are, what the payback is. We work with utilities throughout the state to incorporate utility rebates so that you can really get a very clear idea of what the project cost is going to be out of pocket from the city, from the county, and so what it's going to take to deliver that project. So the assistance that we provide is. You know, largely in that upfront analysis of figuring out where are the really good opportunities here, where is this going to make sense, and where does it not make sense. A lot of times, you know, I mean, we definitely have looked at facilities where we just say, you know, I mean, you could do this, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not going to save you a lot of energy. It might be nice to have new thermostats, but, you know, it's not necessarily a clear winner for you. And so, you know, we're not trying to push projects that aren't, that don't make economic and energy saving sense. So. That's what our technical assistance really is focused on.
Great, thanks. Any more questions from the audience? Okay, I think everybody's getting tired in the afternoon. Also, I had another question for Forrest. Where did I put it? Interior space option. It was like there were a couple. It's so specific. Parking. You know, and the things going with parking, and then there was this sort of broad interior space that sort of, to me, kind of opened up the door to a whole bunch of stuff. And I wonder if it really meant there's a whole bunch of stuff that can be done, or is there something more limiting or not?
Yeah, there is. I mean, you know, open office plans are probably the best suited space type for a wireless lighting control solution, just because it's most likely in that type of configuration where you're going to have different uses happening and different light requirements in different areas that are currently controlled by single circuit. So that's a great opportunity. But also, we've seen it, one of our first wireless control projects was actually in a library. We're seeing another library project coming up. So libraries seem to be a good application as well. I'd say those two in the interior space, other than garages, are the most popular for the wireless lighting controls.
Okay. I also noticed that when you listed out the participants you've had so far, that it felt a little north heavy, is what I'll call it. So I'm just kind of curious if that's just because you started that way, or
that's true. That's really changed a lot. Actually, we've seen by far our most growth in San Diego area. A lot of great cities and counties down there, So San Diego has been a huge area of growth recently. Also, working with Southern California Edison, there's a number of new jurisdictions in Southern California's and territory as well that are coming on board. So we did start in Northern California. We actually, as a part of our application to the Energy Commission, when this the SEP funding was available, we actually had a team of governments that we had that co-submitted with us. And so we started with that base, and then we've been expanding to others as the program has moved on.
Okay. More questions? I have another one then. Brendan, you mentioned that when you had done some test data, or maybe it was Linda, one of you two talked about that you had test data. Is that available?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how would someone get their hands on it?
And it's part of the Energy Working Group. Street Light Working Group. And on my PowerPoint presentation, which you will have, it has the CleanTech San Diego website, and I believe that the Streetlight Working Group is also on the San Diego Gas and Electric website. I'm not positive on that. That information is available. We have a whole document that we've been sharing with whoever wants it.
Okay.
Of all the data.
Okay. Well, certainly Streetlight Working Group best practices study is on the SEEK website and should have links to that information.
Yeah.
They also, I mean, there's specific specifications for both LED and induction that were created for everyone to use,
right.
That are available. So.
And then, Brendan, just one last real quick question. I know you wanted to make a plug about OnBill Finance. So I was just going to.
The real story is that Frank said, well, if I have no questions, what should I ask you? And this was a nice one for Frank. But I still have some left. I'm not 100%. If I go forward with phase two, I still have some streetlights still to do. And then so I hope to use OnBill financing to do the remainder. And with 0% interest, it's a good deal. So it's a little plug for OBF.
Thank you. Yes, please. So just real quick, I think the question is how are cities financing the difference from what the incentives are between the ETAP program and the utility program? How are they financing?
Okay. Yes. So actually, block grants, a lot of cities are using their block grants to finance the difference in that project cost. QECBs are also being looked at, CEC low-interest loans. So a lot of the same funding sources you've heard about from these folks are also being used. In some cases, it's coming out of capital budget or operations and maintenance budgets. Because of the savings that you're going to be creating. But I would say by far block grants is probably the single most common source of funding for our projects. Did that answer, was that your whole question, or I wasn't sure if there was okay. Yes. Yes, absolutely. We've worked very closely actually with all the utilities and talking with their engineers to make sure we're on the same page about how to calculate savings for our measures, and so try to streamline that process as much as possible so that and that's always the case. They're always every agency is getting a utility rebate on top of the ETAP rebate, and there's no problem at all with combining ETAP funds with your block grant or low interest loans, our other RF funding. there's no conflict whatsoever. We had that straightened out early on in the program, so we wanted to make sure that was possible. So. Yeah, none of anything that we do for you is of any cost to you. So the CEC pays for everything. The stimulus funds, the DOE ultimately, is what pays for everything that we do, including all the technical services we provide and the rebates. So there's no cost to you at all.
Great. How about one more question before we break? No more? No, go ahead.
I've heard drivers need to be replaced, is it really maintenance free for 50,000 hours like they advertise?
That's an important part of that warranty that I mentioned. So it's all inclusive, and it actually includes install. So, and I know the City of San Diego did a similar thing with their warranty provisions.
Laurel, did you have a question?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of it depends on your own internal procurement processes and how quickly you can move. So, December 31st is the deadline for that we've established in order to give us time to go in and inspect the project afterwards, and process the rebate application, issue the check. So that's kind of the target date we've set. So you can kind of back calculate from there. How long would you estimate that it takes for you to issue an RFP, or if you can sole source it, that's going to be a lot quicker. But what is your internal process? City council staff report, approval. So it really varies from city to city. We've worked with cities that have been able to sole source; those move through really quickly. The installation is actually usually pretty fast for all of these measures because they're wireless. You're not running a lot of wire. You're not, taking down any walls, or you're not doing a lot of construction work. You're really just sometimes literally pulling down your fixture and putting in your controller and putting it back. So it can go pretty quickly. Garages, a couple garages, 2-week installation. So I would, if you have a project in mind, I'd definitely be happy to talk with you offline, and we can figure out, what it would, when you'd want to get started. I mean, I would encourage you just to get the conversation started as soon as you can, get an application in, reserve your funding, and then we can go from there. But there's still time. We can work with you. I think we would hate to see a project that's done slightly later than the end of the year miss out just because it can be done, January 1. So it's, December 31st we're shooting for. If it's going to trickle over a little bit, we may be able to work with you. So does that answer your question? Okay.
One last question in the back.
Yeah, great question. And, I think that we would love to see more time. I think everyone who's a SEP recipient probably would. We've gotten no indication at all from the Energy Commission that would happen. So that said, we have enough projects in our pipeline. So we track projects from the very beginning when someone calls us to say, hey, what about wireless HVAC in our city hall? And as soon as we have a number to associate, a savings number based on an initial screening, that goes in our tracking database. So if you add up all of those projects in our tracking database, that's enough to spend all of our rebate funding. But that's not going to happen. Some of those projects are going to drop out. Some of them aren't going to be able to move forward in the time frame that they need to. So right now we have reserved. So that means cities or counties have submitted an application, say we're moving forward with this. They've submitted an application that has been signed. That's what reserves your funding. We've reserved just over half of our rebates right now. So that leaves another, a little over $1 million of rebates left.
Okay, well, thank you all for attending the session. We really appreciate it very much. Please join me in thanking our speakers. Thank you.